a series of studies on the book of John. As most all of you are aware, we have completed our study of 1st and 2nd and 3rd John and Jude. And Mark is planning very soon after he completes the studies on the minor prophets on Sunday morning to go directly in the book of Revelation. And so by looking at 1st and 2nd and 3rd John and the gospel according to John and the book of Revelation, then we will have gone through all five books written by the Apostle John. And so consequently, I think it's appropriate that we follow in this particular order. And as most of you are aware, I recently had cataract surgery. It's too soon to have glasses. And so consequently tonight, I'm still walking to some degree by faith and not by sight. But at least hopefully I'll be able to read what's in front of me. If not, you can read it for me. But we're glad that tonight that you're here, and we're starting this book that I think is a very important book. And what I want to do tonight is not go directly into the text in the book of John, but rather to look at the introduction to the book of John, as we have in our outline. And then hopefully next week go directly into the chapter 1 and be looking at each of the verses in their successive order on a verse-by-verse basis. At any rate, tonight we're glad that you're here, and I've made five more workbooks to go along with the 35 that I already had, and I think I need to put together some more, and hopefully I will between now and next Wednesday evening. But is anyone here that needs a workbook tonight? All of us have access to one. That is good. Mark has one in his hand, and I think that probably exhausts what we have right now, but hopefully by next week we'll have a few more, and we keep on until we get all of them taken care of. Anyway, beginning in our lesson tonight and looking at the introduction, we notice in the fourth gospel, namely Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John will be the fourth gospel, differs in style and character and plan from the three synoptic gospels, Matthew and Mark and Luke. Apart from information pertaining to the Lord's suffering, there are but two points of obvious contact between John's gospel and the three synoptic gospels. In particular, we're looking at the feeding of the 5,000. We read about in John chapter 6, verses 5 through 14, in Matthew chapter 14, verses 15 through 21, in Mark chapter 6, verses 34 to 44, and likewise in Luke chapter 9, verses 10 through 17. Remember that the multitude was following Jesus, and they informed him that he needed to send them apart that they might be able to obtain food. And Jesus said, "You give them food to eat," and they couldn't comprehend how that could be done because they only had five barley loaves and two small fishes. But anyway, he blessed the bread, and I say they sat down in groups, and he fed them, and was there enough left over to feed them? What happened? They fed all 5,000 beside the men and the women and the children. And how many baskets full were left over?
12.
And so that was truly a miracle, was it not? I remember when we lived in California, I was on the radio for 4 years, 5 days a week. One of the preceding speakers was talking about his parents when they were in Germany after the war, and how that they had the sympathy for the poor German preachers. His mother invited some 13 German preachers over to their home. They got there, and she looked up in the cupboard, and she only found 1 4-inch loaf of bread. She didn't know what to do. And then she put her hands on the bread and began to pray for it, and the bread got bigger and bigger. The bottom line is, she fed her family and all 13 preachers, German preachers, on that 4-inch loaf of bread. It had not reduced one bit in size. Well, I dealt with that on the radio. And let it be known that if they have that ability, then let's meet with some of these third world countries and bless their meager food supplies and take care of the problems. But I did not get any replies. And so this was a miracle where Jesus is demonstrating his power. And then the walking on water, as we'll learn in John chapter 6 and Matthew chapter 14 and Mark chapter 6. And so these are obvious points of contact between John and also Matthew, Mark, and Luke, the synoptic gospels. Item number two, unlike Matthew, Mark, and Luke, John dealt only with a few incidents in the life of Jesus, covering only really a few days. And item number three, John, more than any other gospel writer, tells the glory from a personal point of view. Remember in John chapter 1, he starts out, "In the beginning was the Word. The Word was with God, and the Word was God, and all things were made by Him, and without Him was not anything made that was made." Then skip on down to verse 14, and he said, "The Word was made flesh." And then what did John say? "And we beheld His glory, full of grace and truth." And so John included himself among those who beheld the glory, the Son of God, that was deity and divinity incarnate in the flesh. And so John, to a large degree, writes from a personal point of view. Any comment before we go on to the outline of John? All right, now looking at the Roman numeral number one outline, the prologue to the book, John chapter 1, verses 1 through 18, where there we have the introduction of the Word being made flesh, and they're beholding in grace and truth, and so on. And then beginning at chapter 1 and verse 19 down through chapter 12, you have the public ministry of Jesus. Then beginning in John chapter 13 down through chapter 17, the private ministry of Jesus. Then John chapter 18 through 20, we have the suffering of the Son of God. Then John chapter 21, victory over death, and some after-death appearances of Jesus. Remember in John chapter 21 that the Lord was raised from the tomb and the disciples were there by the Sea of Gethsemane. They had been fishing all night and had been fruitless. And anyway, the Lord fed them upon that occasion and told them to cast their net over to the right side, and they caught how many large fish? If memory serves me correctly, 253. And so that's quite a success, was it not, from the standpoint of catching fish? Any comment? All right, now looking at item number two in the introduction, the inspired human writer or author of this book was John. Now, who was the real author of the book? And so we learn in 2 Timothy chapter 3 that all Scripture is given by inspiration of God and is profitable for doctrine, for reproof, for correction, and for instruction in righteousness, that the man of God might be what? Complete, thoroughly furnished unto every good work. And so the Bible is all the revelation that we need. We can be complete in it. And so we have then the real author of the Holy Spirit, but John was the one that the Holy Spirit was using to record the information in this book. And so from the standpoint of the author of the book, we have external testimony and I think also internal testimony. On the one hand, the external testimony, Irenaeus, a disciple of Polycarp, who was the disciple of John, ascribed the authorship to the Apostle John. And also others, including Clement of Alexandria, Origen, and Theophilus of Antioch, they also claimed that the writer of this book, the human writer, was John. And so there's quite a bit of external testimony, but internal, as we learn in John chapter 21, we learn in verses 20 to 24, the material in this book was written by the disciple whom Jesus loved. And who was that? When you examine the evidence there in chapter 13 and chapter 20, clearly, 21, Jesus is mentioned as the disciple whom Jesus loved. And Peter and James and John were part of the Lord's inner circle. You remember there in Luke chapter 8, Jairus, his daughter, was sick now to death, and the Lord let how many people go with him into his house to heal the girl? There were Peter and James and John. And in Matthew chapter 17, when the Lord went up to the Mount of Transfiguration, who did he take with him? Peter and James and John. You remember there appeared Moses and Elijah talking with him. And what did Peter say? You got for us to be here, let us make three tabernacles. One for what? The one for Moses, one for Elijah. As Wayne Ernest years ago paraphrased it, let's make three churches. The church of Moses, the church of Elijah, and so on. What happened? God then said, this is my beloved Son in whom I'm well pleased. Hear ye him or them? Him. Moses had his day. Elijah had his day. But now Jesus is the one that we need to be listening to in this the gospel age. And so again, clearly, it would indicate he's a part of the Lord's inner circle. And in Matthew chapter 26, the Lord went in the Garden of Gethsemane. And who did he have with him? Peter and James and John. And so, you look in John chapter 21, Peter was distinguished from the disciple whom Jesus loved. And so clearly, it was not written by Peter. The Lord had talked to Peter regarding the manner of the death by which he would die. And then there was the disciple whom Jesus loved, and Peter, what happened to him? And so, well, what would happen to him? And so Peter did not write the book of John, but the one whom Jesus loved did write it. And I think clearly the indications are that it was John, one of the sons of Zebedee. Now, Peter was distinguished from the disciples whom Jesus loved. And James, by this point in time, was dead. You remember in Acts chapter 12, Herod stretched forth his hand to vex certain of the church, and what did he do? He killed James, the brother of John, with a sword. And so Peter, or James, is now deceased when this book was written. And so it was not James. And I think the indications are that clearly it was the Apostle John. Now, some facts about the Apostle John. He was one of Zebedee's children, one of two sets of brothers called the apostles. You remember in Matthew chapter 4, verses 18 through 22, that Jesus is walking by the Sea of Galilee, and he called two brothers, follow me, and they left their nets and began to follow me, and went on farther, and there were two other sons of Zebedee that were mending their nets. And what did he tell them to do? To follow him, and they left the ship and their net, and they followed him. And so he was one of two sets of brothers that was called to be an apostles. And item number two, he may have been related to Jesus. I think this is a point that we don't often mention. But if you look in Matthew chapter 19 and 25, in Matthew chapter 27, verses 56 and 55, and Mark chapter 15 and verse 42, you'll notice among those who followed at the time was Mary Magdalene and Mary the mother of Jesus. And then we have the two sons of Zebedee that were the mother of the sons of Zebedee. Another reference says, and Salome. It's thought that Salome was the wife of Zebedee, the mother of James and John. Now, if that be the case then, what was the other relation between John and Jesus?
Cousins,
first cousins. And so you look at it from that perspective then, and perhaps we can see another factor that might be involved as one of the reasons why John was a part of the Lord's inner circle. Any comment? Question? Mark?
His mother's sister, which if you look in the
But when you look at the other passages, that would be the one named, only has John and James' mother.
Yeah.
So that would make them sisters. And that would go along here with Jesus putting his mother's care with John.
That's true. Good point. And so on the cross, when the Lord was dying, they said, "Behold thy mother." And then he said to his mother, "Behold what? Thy son." And so when Jesus died, then he provided for the care of his mother through the Apostle John. And John will be close from the standpoint of his character, part of the inner circle, and also because of the family relationship. Anything else on that? And so by reading those references, you see Salome, you see the mother Zebedee's children, and you see Mary's sister. All of those are mentioned when you compare these references. And so Mary's sister, I think, would be Salome, and Zebedee's children, of course, would be James and John, and the mother of them would be Salome, a sister to Mary. And where am I? In my reading. And so getting down to the B part near the bottom of the page.
Number three,
thank you. Generally, except in Luke chapter 9 and verse 28, when James and John are mentioned together, James is mentioned first. But later on, it becomes James and John in the order that they're generally mentioned. And so by this point in time, we get to Acts chapter 12, and James is mentioned as the brother of John. And what happened to James in Acts chapter 12? Herod killed him. And so, looking at Adam number 2 or 4 then, today, he is also known as the apostle of love. Why would that be? Did he have anything to say about love? A whole lot. So you look in John chapter 13 and... Jesus said, we need to love one another even as he loved us. By this shall all men know that you're my disciples if you have love one to another. So he's emphasizing now the kind of love for each other that Jesus had toward them. And in John chapter 15, it's just the importance of love. In John chapter 14, 21 and 23, he let it be known that he who loves me will keep my commandments. And then you look in 1 John chapter 2, 9 through 11, in 1 John chapter 3, 10 through 14, and in 1 John chapter 3 or 4, verses 7 through 11, he has a lot to say about love. And so, what are the qualities of love as we look at it in John, 1 John? If we love one another, we'll do what? We'll take care of them. And so we can see that kind of love. And of course, the primary essence of love, he tells us, chapter 4, that God is what? He that loveth not knoweth not God, for God is love. So if you want a one-word description of God, what would be the best word to use? Love. And so God so loved the world that he gave his only begotten son. And so he's known as the apostle of love, and yet it seems that initially he had a pretty hot temper. You look in Mark chapter 3, there were James and John, and the Lord gave them the surname of what? Boanerges or whatever. What does that mean? Sons of thunder. And you look at Luke chapter 9, the Lord going towards Samaria, and they were not receiving, wanting to receive Jesus. And what did James and John suggest? Shall we not call down fire from heaven and consume them, even as Elijah did? And looking back to 2 Kings chapter 1, where Elijah was calling down fire from heaven to consume those whom the king had sent to inquire because of the God of Ekron, an idol god as opposed to the God of heaven. And so James and John are ready at that point in time to call down fire from heaven to consume them. Does that sound like love? So could you maybe conclude then that maybe some changes had taken place in John's life? Can you reach that conclusion? Can you? But on the other hand, is that not to be expected? You think back to the time before you became a Christian, and you look at your life right now. Are you the same person now that you were then? There's been a lot of changes, right? Changes for the better. And so we learn to put away wrath and demonstrate love one to another and care for one another. And then Colossians chapter 2, we need to be knitted together in love. Obviously, I never had done any knitting, but my mother knew something about it. And what about knitting? What about all the strings? Are they not woven real tight and close to one another? Isn't that what happens when you're knitting? And we need to be what? Knit together in love. And I'm thankful that I believe that pretty well describes this congregation. Any comment before we leave page number one? Don't all of you talk at once. All right, let's turn now to page number two and continue. Item number five, the only apostle to follow Jesus to the place where Jesus was tried was John. Now, they were going to the high priest's place, and there was Peter, and there was John, and John was allowed to go on in. I think evidently he's pretty well acquainted. He wrote five books of the New Testament, 1st and 2nd and 3rd John, and John in Revelation. And the one into which the hands of the dying Savior committed to the care of his beloved mother, as we note in John chapter 19 and 26. Anything else? All right, let's look at item number three. And that's really what I want to cover in the balance of the time tonight. And then next week we'll try to go directly into the text. But item number three, the purpose for writing this book. Remember in John chapter 20, 30 and 31, I think it's quite often that when you begin to read a book, you see early on why the book was written. But I think John is taking a little different approach. When you get to the end of John chapter 20, 30 and 31, many other signs truly to Jesus and the presence of his disciples that are not written in this book, but these are written what? That you might believe what? Believe that Jesus is the Christ and believe that you might have life on his name. So I think one main purpose for the writing of this book is that we might believe that Jesus is the Christ. And I fully believe that if we mentally investigate the contents of this book that we're starting to study tonight, when we get through the end of the book, I think our faith will be strengthened. We already believe, but I think our faith will want to be strengthened as we come to the conclusion. And so, item number 3A on page 2, the seven amazing miracles that Jesus performed are recorded in this book. Now, you look in John chapter 2, verses 1 through 11. What was the first recorded miracle that Jesus performed? Turning water into wine. And then in John chapter 4, you have the healing of the nobleman's son, demonstrating power over disease, showing himself the master of distance and a space. And out of a third one, the healing of the lame man in John chapter 5, verses 1 through 39. Man had been healed, 38 had been healed, had been lame for some 38 years, and Jesus healed him. And then you have the feeding of the 5,000 in John chapter 6. And then the walking on water in John chapter 6. Then restoring sight to the blind in John chapter 9. Remember, there was a man that was a lame, that was blind from his mother's womb. And the disciples don't know who sinned, this man or his mother before him, or his parents before him. And Jesus let it be known it was not based upon their sins, but rather that the glory of God might be done. So what didn't happen then? Jesus spat upon the ground, he made clay on the spittle, and what happened? He said, go and wash. And what happened? He went and washed. And he came back seeing. Then raising the dead in John chapter 11. There was Mary and Martha and Lazarus, their brother. And they sent word to Jesus that Lazarus is what? Very sick. But Jesus did not go immediately when he went. Then by that point in time, Lazarus had been dead for how many days? I believe it's 4 days, if I remember. And what happened? Went to the tomb. He said, roll away the stone. And what did Jesus do? He said, Lazarus, come forth. And what happened? He came forth. He's raised from the dead. And so you have these seven amazing miracles that demonstrated the Lord's omnipotence and the Lord's power. Any comment? Any questions? All right, number B then. You have the four testimonies declaring his deity and divinity. On the one hand, you have in John chapter 5 the testimony of John the Baptist, who affirmed concerning Jesus as to his identity. Then the testimony of the Father. He said the Father bears witness. What in the Old Testament? The testimony of two or three witnesses. But here we have the testimony of John, the testimony of the Father. And what about the works that he did? He said, the works that I do, they bear witness on me. And what else? What was another testimony that bore witness, another source bearing witness to the deity of Jesus? What did John 5 and 39 say? You search the scriptures? For they are they that testify of me. And what scriptures were they searching? The Old Testament. And so the Old Testament scriptures then, they testified of Jesus and it was noted upon different occasions and in Luke chapter 24. Jesus let it be known that the law and the prophets and the Psalms, they bore witness of him. And so Jesus really was he's the centerpiece of the Bible. The Old Testament looking forward to his coming. The New Testament begins with an announcement of his arrival. And it begins and ends and letting us know he's coming again. He's the hub of the Bible. Any comment? Now, in item number C, with the I Am sayings of Jesus. Now, think about I Am. What's the first example of that you can recall in the Bible? Exodus chapter 3. And what now? And God is calling Moses to lead the Israelite people out of the bondage of Egypt. Was Moses eager to go, or did he have some reason not to go, or excuses? He said, I'm not eloquent, and so on. But nevertheless, who shall I say has sent me? And God said, I am that I am. And in John chapter 8, as the Lord is discussing with the Jewish leaders, the Lord said, before Abraham was, I am. And so the deity, the divinity that characterized God the Father characterizes the Son of God. And so then we notice some of the I am sayings, some seven of them. I am the bread of life. John chapter 8, verse 35 and 48. And I'm the light of the world. John chapter 8 and 12, and John chapter 9, verse 5. And I'm the door, John chapter 10. I'm the good shepherd, in John chapter 10 also, verses 13 and 14. I'm the resurrection and the life, John chapter 11, and verse 25. You remember in John chapter 11 when Lazarus had died, and now the Lord has come, and Mary is grieving, if you'd been here, my brother had not died. The Lord said that he'll live again. He goes on to say that I'm the resurrection and the life. In John chapter 14, probably one of the most memorable, memorized, he said, I'm the way, what? the truth, and the life. No man comes unto the Father but by me. And then in John chapter 15, he said, I am what? I am the true vine, and you're the branches. And then we have another witness bearing testimony to the deity, the divinity of Jesus, is a resurrection. And so, you remember in John chapter 20, when Mary had informed Peter and John of the resurrection of Jesus, and they ran to the tomb, and John outran Peter. But on the other hand, when they arrived, John stooped down and looked, and what did Peter do? He just plunged on in. But at any rate, we can truly see here where Jesus is indeed the Son of God. And you think about the resurrection. I think, to me, the Bible has many, many amazing miracles. But which one do you think would really be the one most amazing? That would really prove conclusively that Jesus is the Son of God. I think the resurrection. Mark, I think it's Romans 1:4. I'll let you read that. If I got the wrong one, I'll apologize. Romans chapter 1 and verse 4, I think's what I'm thinking about. All right, very good. And so, declared to be the Son of God with power, according to the Spirit of holiness, by what? By the resurrection from the dead. And that the Lord had declared, the Son of God will be delivered up by the Jews and be crucified and be raised again the third day. And that was something they simply could not believe. And then they went to Pilate and make sure you have a watch so that his disciples don't come by night and steal his body, unless there would be worse than the first. And what did Pilate say? You have a watch, go your way, make it as sure as you can. And yet when they came to the tomb of Jesus, what about it? The tomb was empty. The angel said, he's not here. He's risen. And you can be sure that from that point in time, it had a profound impact upon the people, knowing that this is indeed the Son of the living God. You think about the great result of the Sermon upon the Day of Pentecost, when some 3,000 souls heard the first gospel sermon in this, the gospel age, and they believed and they were baptized. But what went before that particular event that would help them, I think, pave the way for the great result on that day. Let's suppose that you were living back during that time period and you heard about this man called Jesus and the great works that he did. Now that he'd been crucified, and yet he had mentioned before him repeatedly, I'm going to be crucified, but I'm going to be raised again. And then you learn that they put guards at the tomb to make sure nobody could steal his body by night. And yet they went to the tomb, and it's empty. Then you have the Lord's post-resurrection appearances. Now you think about you living in that day in Jerusalem, and you're reading in the Jerusalem Chronicle. It had just published the fact that Jesus is crucified. But now earlier in the first of the week, they come out, the tomb of Jesus is empty. And he's alive, and he's appeared unto many. You have all of that behind you. And then you have the day of Pentecost, when you have Jews from all over the Roman Empire coming to observe the Pentecost day, and the disciples now being able to speak with other tongues or languages as the Spirit gave them utterance. Then Peter standing up and quoting from their Old Testament, proving that this one that the Old Testament prophets have spoken about is indeed the Son of God, and that God has made the Jesus whom you crucified both Lord and Christ. Now they are convinced. The one that we put to death, God raised him from the dead. If you'd been a part of that crowd that cried out, let him be crucified, how would you feel upon that occasion? You'd be pricked in your heart. in all likelihood, asking along with others, what shall we do? And so truly, his resurrection is conclusive proof that he is indeed the Son of the living God. And I remember back in 2001, when we were in Jerusalem, and then going into seeing the Golgotha, and then over near that, the tomb where the stone is poured away, and going inside the tomb, and I cannot prove conclusively that that's where he was buried, but I think there's good indication it might be. And you look inside the tomb, and then as you go out, you see a sign on the door, on the wall, he's not here, he's risen. You know, that gave me quite a feeling to think I may be in the very place where the Son of God was, but he wasn't there. He's risen. Any comment? Has the last bell rang? All right, very good.
Bobby, I noticed that there are seven I Ams. There are seven miracles.
Okay. So seven is considered a perfect number, and you're exactly right. You have the seven miracles that are recorded and the seven I Am sayings of Jesus. And when we get to Revelation, it's going to be 777. Truly, the Bible is a profound book. It has all the earmarks, all the evidences of being a book that came from God.